This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm interviewing Christina Thompson about her memoir, which is called Come on Shore and We Will Kill and Eat You All. And I guess the subtitle, which helps explain the title, A New Zealand Story. Hi, Christina. How are you?
I'm fine.
So this, it does have a pretty catchy title. was this your idea or just publisher's idea? I'm kind of curious about that.
Oh, no, that was my idea. And the funny thing about the title is that I had the title years before I had the book. The title is actually taken from Charles Darwin, actually Cook via Charles Darwin, Captain Cook via Charles Darwin. And I had come across it years and years before when I was a graduate student doing some of the research that is behind the book. So I had it for a long time, and it was my idea. The publishers were very excited because it was sensational, and they thought it would get attention.
Well, it does. I think it immediately, although it does, it certainly has some ambiguity because you really don't know what it's about. And that's partly the ambiguity, I think, is actually at the core of that phraseology. That, if that's a word, that, we'll talk about that in a minute, because I want to sort of explain, I want you to explain what the book is about, because that has a lot to do with the title of the book.
Right. It's kind of complicated, you're right. and it's true that also that some people were not crazy about the title. I mean, there was, the blogosphere was filled with commentary about the title, mostly by people who never read the book. So there were lots of people saying, this is the funniest title I've read, and there were lots of people saying, I don't get it, and there were people saying, this is really horrible. And
right,
know.
Sort of, could imagine it as insulting in a certain way to native people in Polynesia.
Right. Definitely, definitely. But there was a certain amount of response like that in New Zealand, too.
Well, maybe you could talk a little bit about how you came to the, not necessarily to writing the book, but go back to, the story in your life of, how you got to New Zealand, because it's a great, I think the beginning of the book, it's great. It's a great, I mean, I like the book overall, but I think that it's a great kind of, the way you tell the beginning, it's kind of flat and matter of fact without any of the emotional content that goes into, stories about personal relationships. And
right.
It was kind of, you wrote it without reference to the meanings and the emotions. It was just, this is what happened, this is how I got here, and then this interesting thing happened.
Right.
So maybe you could talk about that.
Well, so the basic backstory is that I was, when I decided to go to graduate school and I got a fellowship, I got a couple of fellowships, and I went to Australia. And I was a graduate student in Australia for a couple of years, and I was studying, I was really reading Australian literature, and then I was reading about Australian history, and then I was reading about the wider history of the Pacific, mainly the kind of colonial history of the Pacific when the British came and so on and so forth. So that was background for me, and then I'd been there for about 3 years, I guess, and I went home, which was Boston. So I had to go from Australia to Boston via California, and when I came, I went home for Christmas, and when I came back, I stopped in New Zealand on the way home, on the way back to Australia, because New Zealand's in between. So, and I was there as a tourist. I had a week, and I thought I would go up to, it was summertime in the Southern Hemisphere, Christmas time here, and I decided to go up to Northland, up the north of Auckland, which is where the really nice beaches are and stuff like that. So I went up there, and that was where, that's kind of where the story begins, is when I get there.
Right. And just sort of accidentally, you fall in with these Maoris.
Right. So I go to this bar, basically, this pub, and I get interested in what's going on there. And I'm standing around with these Maoris, these Maori guys, mostly guys. There were some women there, but mostly it was a bunch of guys I was standing around with. And this fight breaks out in the pub. And I'm completely baffled by it and what's going on. And I turn to this guy and I say, hey, whoa, what's happening here? And he just went, I don't know. I mean, he said, I guess somebody, said something somebody didn't like. And he was completely nonplussed by what was taking place. And I was very startled and kind of intrigued by what was taking place. And at that point, I had this moment where I suddenly thought to myself, there's a lot more going on here than I am understanding. This is really interesting.
And so it became a kind of, in some ways, you were studying, studying to be an anthropologist, and so it puts you in the position of kind of accidentally coming across the notion that anthropology does have to explore all the time, and that is the difference between, and I'll put it, in these terms, appearance and reality, that
Right.
the way things look to an outsider of a culture are, we can pretty certainly say, are not the way things actually are within that culture.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the thing that I was seeing, which was, later, years later, when I was reflecting on this, was still funny to me. What I was seeing was an encounter between a white guy and a Maori guy who were beating each other up, and I just instantly peopled that scenario with sort of gave it racial implications. And it turned out that I had completely misunderstood it, that the Maori guy was the intruder, the white guy was the local who was accepted by the Maori locals as their guy. I mean, I just had it all wrong, as one does most of
Right,
the
and so,
time.
and well, maybe that, and that kind of becomes the theme of the book. I mean, I should say, the book is your, it's a personal memoir, but you, there's, it's not just your story, obviously. You're using your story to then take off on and explore all sorts of things having to do with cultural relations, the colonialism of the principally Oceania, but not only Oceania. It gets, it enables you to talk about a lot of different things, but it's all structured based on the story of your own life. And I'm kind of curious about how you came to the building of that storyline. How did you decide what book to write when you were writing this?
Right. Actually, that was a huge issue for me. And the piece of information that you basically one needs to understand how this happened is that the guy that I was talking to in the pub is the guy that I then married
Right, we didn't
from
get to that yet, and I should have said that
Korea.
before,
Right.
because
Right.
that becomes, that's the thing that I was mentioning, that you, this hugely emotional and powerful thing that you treated as kind of a throwaway. It's like an off the cuff. I just, here I am. Well, now I'm married. I mean, it didn't quite come out that way, but that's what launches the story.
Right. Well, part of the reason for that, and this definitely was surprising to a lot of people. A lot of people noticed this. Part of the reason was this, is that it was not, in my mind, a book about my marriage. It was not a book about my life, and it was not a book about my anything. However, I realized as I was working on it, that what motivated me to write it was, in fact, not so much my marriage as my children. Because I have three sons, we have three sons, and so they are what in used to be called half caste, and they have mixed ancestry, and their ancestry is interesting to me because basically the two peoples that they come from were kind of at war with one another for quite a long time, and they are the, in some sense, direct kind of product of this period of conflict and contest between these two groups of people. So that's what I was really investigating at a kind of, the sort of intellectual level. But I was motivated, I was driven to do it by a very kind of deep emotional and personal desire to sort of explain who they were. Not that they care, mind you, they don't care. But to me, it was important to sort of say, this, you look back into your own history, this is what you would see.
Well,
So.
yeah, in a certain way, it's, maybe it doesn't matter to them now. I mean, I know your children are not fully grown, but maybe when kids seem to, there are certain things they don't care about or need to know about, but then later they will.
That's right. I know that later it will be interesting to them. But so that's why, so it was sort of the combination of both. There's, on the one hand, sort of an intellectual inquiry into the nature of contact between these two different cultural groups, or any two cultural groups. And at the same time, this sort of personal story about, I met this guy and I married him and we had these kids and we traveled around the world and things were tough and, so on and so forth. So they're those two completely different stories, right? And
Right.
so the whole question of how to fit those together into a common narrative, it was pretty challenging. And most of the people who have responded to the book, both favorably and unfavorably, have commented. The most common word that people use to describe it, and I think they're talking about the narrative structure, is unusual. It was
It
just.
is. No, but it works. I mean, it does have, I don't think it's out of line with a sort of I think there are memoir forms. This sort of personal narrative form is not, it's no longer totally unusual. That there are other books, and of course I can never think of the ones that I'm think really the titles of the ones I mean, but there are other books I've read which have built on a personal story but then have gone off on tangents. And these are not necessarily tangents that don't make sense. They're tangents that do make sense, but they're not necessarily the, as you said, they're, it's not all about you, but it uses your story to link other stories and to bring them all together. It is a sort of weaving into a you know a complete story, a bunch of strands of other things.
Yeah.
You know, so you're exploring Maori history, you're exploring you know, the way Polynesian, I mean, I think a huge amount of really amazing stuff about the nature of Polynesian culture. And, you know, you touch on some of the open questions or argumentative questions in anthropology about, you know, whether the Polynesians had contact with South America and how much back and forth there was, and, you know, some amazing stuff about Polynesian oceanic explorations, which I didn't realize. I mean, there's a lot of new information, even for someone who is fairly knowledgeable about, you know, let's say anthropological issues. You've there, you know, the whole discussion about the stages of Polynesian exploration. I never realized that there was this older period of large boat exploration that then ended, which you talked about. You know, you know, as part in part of the book.
Which is actually the book I'm writing now. Funny you should mention it.
You mean about that period?
Yeah. It's the story of the settlement of Oceania. Yeah.
Right, where these people, well, you obviously you know more about it than I do, but they're people who came from, it sounds like they came from the, and I'll see if I can get this right, it would be going west to east.
Right. Right,
Yes.
right, right. They're traveling to the towards the east, and they come from the Western Pacific, so they're coming out of Indonesia, the Philippines, Southeast Asia, islands, Southeast Asia.
And so, can you draw the cultural connections between Polynesia and Indonesian native cultures today?
There are ways of doing it, and certainly the thing is that Polynesian language is an Austronesian language, and there are Austronesian languages all over island Southeast Asia and throughout Indonesia into the Philippines, Taiwan. You know, and all the way over to Madagascar.
Right.
So that is obviously one way to do it. A lot of the maritime technology seems to have arisen in places like around Indonesia. So, you know, the use of the outriggers probably comes
Yep.
from there. And so there are a lot of different ways to do it. In terms of contemporary culture, I don't know. These are some probably, you know, thousands of years now. So.
Well, you might see it in language. I mean, I actually am pretty familiar with language change over time, and I think to me that's a really and I think culture changes at a similar rate, the way language does. So if, you know, if the language historian systems apply and work, you should be able to see it in, you know, some cultural
I think you can definitely. It's just the thing is that it's a very, very large area and a lot of different subcultures, a lot of cultural groups. So you'd have to. I mean, my knowledge of what's going on in the Indonesian, all the many Indonesian groups, is sort of limited.
And
So.
when I guess it would be similar to what happens in biology with although over a shorter period of time, so not as clear, but you have you know, islands particularly cause development to go in different directions than
Right,
it.
genetic drift and
Yes.
founder effects and things like that. Yeah, absolutely. So you get all those kinds of interesting shifts and the
And that,
isolated populations.
right, and that was one thing that I th really struck me was that you had this period where the navigation of these large distances was done because the, you know, that actually was going on, and then it, since it stopped, it would enable the kind of outrigger groups to just stay where they are and not have further contact.
Right, they become really isolated is what happens. I
Right.
mean, one of the really interesting things about Polynesia is that after the period of exchange and migration and, you know, this kind of back and forth, to whatever extent it was carried out, then after a certain point they become isolated. And then they start to change apart, move apart from each other in interesting ways.
Exactly. Now,
Yeah.
did I get it right that you have Hawaii, it would be kind of at the end of that migration?
The last is New Zealand. New Zealand is the
Okay.
last one.
But
Hawaii
Hawaii.
is late, but it's not the last. New Zealand is the
And there
last.
was that one scene, I think, when your husband and you were in Hawaii, and there's a kind of recognition from Maori to Hawaiian.
Right. Well, it's funny because this is exactly where I'm starting off, and then it's funny you should mention that because it's sort of the starting point for my new book, and there is a sense in which Polynesians are so close to one another from island to island, but the colonial period has interfered with their connection with each other. First, they were isolated by the fact that they were no longer doing the voyaging, but then the colonial period has affected different islands differently. You know, because there've been the French, or there've been the English, or there were the Spaniards, or there were this, or there that, or they were, separate. Or so in a way, what's happened is Polynesia's kind of being reunited in a funny way. And of course, a lot of Polynesians are poor, so they don't travel the way we do. So they don't go to Tahiti and meet their cousins, But my husband does. So anyway, it's been kind of exciting.
So in one period of the book, now we'll go kind of back to some of the storyline. You and your husband were in you you he came to see you in Australia, and I think did you get married in Australia, if I remember
Yeah,
that
we
right?
did.
So he was dislocated, and I thought it was really interesting how, and you're dislocated too. You're American living in Australia. He's Maori living in Australia, and really being Maori from New Zealand is not all that comfortable in Australia, even though we might from America think of New Zealand and Australia as side by side and they have similar cultures. Maori and Australia don't go together.
Right. There's no relationship whatsoever culturally, historically, whatever between Australian Aborigines and Maori in New Zealand. So there's no link there. And Australia can be a challenging place if you're not white.
Right. So you lived there for a period of time, and you talked about that, I think. But I think that it wasn't the focus of the book, was, as you said earlier, your personal story. But it does, there's things happen there, and it's kind of interesting to see you constantly moving around throughout.
One of the things that's kind of interesting for me that I didn't realize until I went back and looked at it was that, as you say, we were neither of us at home there. We were both strangers in this place, and yet it was a really easy place for us to live. This was Melbourne in Australia, so that was a particular city and a particular kind of a part of Australia. But we were very happy there. It was very easy for us to be there because it kind of allowed us both to reinvent ourselves in the way that, when you go someplace, you go off to college or you go to a new city or whatever, and you get to say who you are all over again. And I think that we both experienced a sort of liberating effects of that there.
And maybe
We were very
that,
happy there.
yeah, and that seems to have carried over. I mean, I guess I was meaning to ask about this or observe this because, when you talk about your husband, he seems very comfortable in all of these different places. He's very happy, as you point out. He doesn't feel like a big pull to go back home. He's not homesick. He's not constantly feeling like he has to go back to New Zealand. He seems pretty happy being in these new places where he gets to reinvent himself.
I think that is really true. I think he really was. I think it was liberating, and I think it was also because he's a very nice person. People like him very quickly, and it's easy for him to go to new places because he's not aggressive or challenging or threatening, and he doesn't have a chip on his shoulder, so he finds it very easy to be. He gets along with people well. So he had very good responses from people, and people were, especially when he got to the United States, people were really interested in him, who he was and where he came from, and it was all good, really.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I mean,
Well, the thing is that, when we're in New Zealand, it's challenging for him in some respects because he all of a sudden has all the obligations that come with being a part of a big family. And when we came back to the United States, I suddenly remembered all of the obligations that came with being part of a community and a culture and a family and all that stuff. And in some ways, that's hard. In some ways, it's good. It's one is in the embrace of the family, and that's nice. But at the same time, it has its limitations too. So we've kind of gone back and forth experiencing all variations on this theme.
So you've been in America with your family and in New Zealand with his family at various
Yes.
times.
Yes.
But it seems like you've been in America more now. I mean, in other words, his dislocation is more extreme than yours now.
It is now. I mean, when I, in the beginning of the story, I had been away, or for a long, before we came back to the United States, I'd been away for 15 years, and now he's been away for about 12.
Right.
So, or maybe 15 if you can count the years in Australia. So about equal.
And the distances are, these are kind of challenging distances. It's expensive to go back and forth between America and New Zealand. So obviously that's not something you can do all the time. And there's some painfulness in the book about those things where people die who were close to you or close to him in, or close to both of you in New Zealand.
His father died when we were in Hawaii, and there wasn't really any way for all of us to go back. He took our very small son at that point to go back to see his father just before he died. And then when we came back to the United States, it was really because I thought my father was just about to die. So we moved back for that reason. And that is what has prompted us. And then we did, my husband didn't go back to New Zealand for the last 12 years until last year, and his mother is getting on, and I keep saying to him, "You've got to go back. You got to go back more often. Just go because she's old now." And
Right. No, that's really hard. I think that,
yeah.
we live in a, obviously the modern world is very disconnective. It opens these possibilities for people to experience themselves, as you said, to make themselves all over again and to experience places that were otherwise foreign to them, not just as tourists, but to actually live in places. But it does have that, difficulty of taking us away from family and, the kind of more locale based living that was up until maybe 100 years ago was the norm for
Yeah.
most people.
The other problem that it does, the other thing that this kind of, these kinds of, especially these kinds of relationships where people come from opposite sides of the world, is that at some point you have to make decisions about what your children are going to experience. And,
Yeah, no, that's profoundly, I think that's really important.
it is.
For you now, I don't think that really comes up so much in the book, but I think it must be interesting, if to say the least, to be half Maori and half American anywhere in the world. You're fairly unusual because the Maori is not a huge cultural group. It's not like there are lots of,
Right.
Maori Americans around.
Right,
So
right.
how do they, and again, if you don't want, if personal to you, so you may not want to talk about it, but this is something that you have to deal with them, or do they just kind of move along and move on and not worry about it?
Well, they do tend to move along and not worry about it, partly because they've grown up in America, so they tend to think of themselves as just Americans. But I feel a little bad that they haven't had as much exposure to the Maori side of their family as would have been ideal, because there are things they don't know, and there are things they don't understand, and there are people they don't know. So as you say, the distances and the cost have really been the barrier for us. We just couldn't keep traveling with three children. So once we had three, we didn't do it anymore. We just couldn't do it. So we have not given them the level of exposure to their own family that I think really would have been ideal. And eventually, what I've been always sort of secretly hoping is that they would do it themselves. That at some point they would get in their lives and they would go, "Hey, what is this other? What's this other side? I think I better go find out." And then it would be kind of, be an adventure for them. I think that's probably what will happen. I
Although
hope.
I can imagine it, again, this is sort of not necessarily knowing, but it seems like it would be complicated and difficult to be so disconnected. And I don't mean this to, in a negative way, but just if you, because they don't know the language necessarily, and they've not experienced the day-to-day culture. So it's hard to reconnect, because you're not really reconnecting, you're having to connect from the beginning to a
Right.
culture that, even though it is in your genetic stock, is really, and it may be still through your one parent, who has got to be influencing you in clearly cultural ways, but you're really not, you didn't grow up in that culture, so you're missing certain key elements of language and behavior that only a native participant would have.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's absolutely true. They're always going to be Americans. They're always going to be strangers. But the difference is that from the other end, they will always be family. So they will always be received as family, even if they're dumb, like even if they don't know how to open an
Right.
oyster, even if they don't know how to do anything correctly, they will always be family. There's such a strong you know, the bloodline thing is really important. It's in New Zealand. It's sort of, you know, who you're descended from is really important. So they will always be accepted, even if people will laugh at them, which they will do. So as long as the kids understand that, when they go back, they just have to, you know, take it on the chin, you know, which is the key sort of behavioral posture. that as long as they understand that people are, they will always be welcomed warmly in an important way.
No, so I think actually that's very profound. I think that, you know, there are some cultures which probably would be less welcoming. I don't know that for sure, but it sounds like the Maori, partially because, as you talked about in the book, it is a small group. So there aren't that many Maoris. And as you said, the family is hugely important and the bloodline is hugely important. So that even today, Maori, maybe conflicts and relationships in those conflicts are still alive, even though something might have happened years and years ago that no one can remember why they have this issue. You know, it's still alive.
Right, right, right. That stuff can be pretty deep. And it definitely puts the children in a different relationship to the family than, for example, me, because I am always an outsider. I mean, it doesn't matter. I could live there my entire life and I'd be an outsider.
Right.
And that would be okay. I mean, I don't think that's a bad thing. It's just that the fundamental level of acceptance of the children is going to be different and always will be different, no matter how they behave and what they do. So that's kind of cool for them, I think.
No, it is. Well, it's cool to have another culture. It sort of reminds me of somebody I know who's, there are Canadians who live in America, and their children get to be Canadian citizens as well as American citizens. And that seems kind of cool to me, you know, that you get to, even though you didn't grow up in Canada, you may not know it well, you know, it's kind of a place that you can have as an other home. Well, not everybody gets that.
We did that with the children, make sure that they had, I mean, they have New Zealand citizenship naturally by descent, and they, of course, have American citizenship by descent, but they also have Australian citizenship because
wow.
I was a naturalized Australian. So
wow.
So they have three passports each.
That could be complicated going in,
going in and out.
Yeah. Wow. Now, how did you become a naturalized Australian? That's an interesting idea.
Well, I was there a long time. I was 15 years living in Australia, so and I had the equivalent of a green card once I married my husband, because for sort of technical reasons, because New Zealanders are eligible for those.
Right.
So I had I had residency, and then I was there for long enough so I could just apply.
And so it doesn't mean you didn't have to give up your American citizenship to
no.
do that.
No, I just.
Well, that's so interesting.
Australian. I know. I'm honorary Australian.
Right. Well, that's good. No, I think it's good to be. I mean, Australians are good. But so I guess this other thing that struck me in the book, I didn't want to fail to mention this because it was so interesting. You know, you talked about the earliest contact between Europeans and New Zealand. I think it's 1642 is the official
right.
kind of first contact. And there's a lot of the book is about that early stage of contact, and that's kind of gets us to the title of the book. There's this whole thing going on with the Maori that the Europeans did not understand. They didn't understand how they were being seen or treated or understood. And I thought that was really, really interesting. But there's the fact of your heritage, which is that in the your I think you have a relative who landed in America in 1642.
Right, exactly.
So there's this kind of interesting way of imagining your family coming to America at the very same time Europeans were maybe meeting with your husband's ancestors.
Right. I kept thinking that it was the Dutch in 1642 in New Zealand, but the English followed hard on their heels. And I just kept thinking, you know, my particular English ancestors came here, but they could have gone there. I mean, there are millions, there are probably hundreds of people in New Zealand with the same names, even the whole set of family names that I have. It's just an accident of history. And it struck me really forcibly that we, my own ancestors, were participating in kind of exactly the same behaviors kind of on the frontier in the United States, not only in settling, kind of arriving in 1642, but then settling in Minnesota, you know, in the sort of same part of the 19th century. that you see a lot of the stuff going on in New Zealand, a lot of this kind of early settlement stuff going on, where there's a lot of conflict and a lot of ambivalence on everybody's part. It's a very complicated and interesting period. And I was really concerned about trying to add some complexity and some depth to some of the portrayals of these early contact encounters, because what we in our particular moment in history have arrived at is the idea that the white people were really bad and that the indigenous people were really good and that they were victimized and that the white people were horrible, and you know, there was a lot of that. There's no doubt about that. But it was also a really much more complicated interaction than most people understand, you know, in terms of who was buying what, who was selling what, who was killing whom, who was taking, you know, trophies, who was, you know, torturing whom. It was complex. And there aren't really good people and bad people so much. There are greater numbers on one side, lesser numbers on the other side, one technology on one side, another technology on the other. But it isn't so black and white as it typically gets represented.
Right, and there's clearly differences of understanding on either side as well. We tend to focus, I think, today on the misunderstanding by the Europeans of the native tribes. I mean, that's fairly well known, or, you know, that wherever they went, they applied their own worldview to what they were seeing.
Right.
But you know what? It has to be true the other direction.
Exactly.
The apperception of these invaders, whatever they were, these arrivers, was different. You know, who knows what people on the other side were thinking of them, because it's not recorded, it isn't written down. We have no way really to know how they were seen and what they were thinking about them. But they clearly didn't understand each other and probably couldn't.
Right, right. And you know, there's no real need to attribute to one side or the other, you know, evil intentions or good intentions. It's just that these people are human on both sides. Everybody acts in his own sort of self-interest at some moments, and at other moments, you know, flashes of charity or whatever. Anyway, that was the aspect of contact culture that was sort of driving me on, was the fact that it was really interesting and deep and full of ambiguity.
Very much so. Well, I mean, I think that is a very anthropological way of looking at cultures in collision, that it, you know, the modern anthropologist has a kind of super relativist view, because there's so many things you can't know, and you also can't make judgments about so many things that are unavailable to you.
Right. Well, and the sort of, for me, the kind of the reason for writing the book in a way, or maybe the, I don't know, one of the ideas behind the book was that I was experiencing these kinds of ambiguities in my own relationship, cross-cultural ambiguities, so that I would say things and my husband would say other things back to me, and I would realize that we were like, you know, two ships passing in the night. You know, his idea of what was going on was really different from my idea of what was going on. And we weren't that different, after all. We were both speaking English, and, you know, we had both grown up in a modern world and so on and so forth, but still there were these sort of residual miscommunications and misunderstandings that I felt like they gave me some insight into how deep that must have been.
Well, do you think this kind of observation could be applied, or would you dare to make that observation apply to other relationships, so that if you look at in America today, which is, you know, fairly commonly felt to be made up of two different or multiple worldviews that don't really mesh. You know, even though it's America, within it there are very different worldviews going on, whether it's cultural or political or whatever. You know, I wonder if you could apply some of the lessons that you learn through your experience that are communicated in your book to people in other circumstances.
It's a really good question. You know, one of the things that happened to me a lot that sort of struck me funny when the first book was first published was I got a lot of mail from people who said, "Wow, you know, that's exactly, I understand this perfectly. You know, my husband is French," or something. And I wasn't expecting for people to abstract this idea of the difficulty of communication with people across almost any kind of cultural or social, or people would say, a lot of people would also write to me if they had understood the class difference Because one of the things is that I struggled with a lot was to try and understand which things were cultural and which things arose out of coming from different social classes, because my husband comes from a much more working class background than I do. So some of that stuff comes from class and what you learn by being a member of a class, and some of it comes from your cultural knowledge, and some of it's all mixed up. And I had a lot of mail from people who had similar experiences, but across all different kinds of lines.
Right.
Political,
No, no, I
social,
think that's, yeah.
cultural, yeah.
I think that's very actually, I think that's good. I think it's gratifying that people are able to take from this a broad, maybe I don't want to say a broader message, but at least maybe a broader understanding of how to think about differences.
Right, exactly. And I guess part, you know, at some level, the message may be that maybe you're not going to understand each other perfectly,
Right, no, I think that is
and
the
that's
message,
okay.
actually. Right, no, I think clearly that is the message. In other words, no one is able to say, after reading this book, well, we should all be the same. You know, we have the same experiences. You can't do that. It's clear that experience going back generations, whatever it may be, whether it's, as in this case, you know, two different groups of people from different parts of the world, or maybe it is impossible to understand the people who live in West Virginia if you live in, you know, if you live in Massachusetts. I mean, there are, you know, but it does, it's okay, as you say. You know, you don't have to have the same experience. And actually, as the world becomes more globalized, I think people forget how different cultures have been in the past because it's not as obvious, you know, and there's this sense that people take that, well, it's mass culture, globalization, we're all watching the same TV shows, and that does create a certain form of uniformity of culture. You know, everybody goes to McDonald's, and McDonald's in China is, you know, McDonald's in America, but it doesn't escape the fact that experience is so variable across.
I had two comments from both from people from New Zealand about the book that were very interesting to me. One was somebody who said, "Oh, come on, you know, Maoris have all everybody in New Zealand's been watching American TV for years. Your husband couldn't have had an experience of disorientation when he got to America." And I thought, "Whoa, that is so naive. As if watching American television will prepare you to walk into the living room of, you know, these Cambridge, you know, academics. I mean,
Right. Well, turn it the
hello."
right. Turn it around the other way. Reading your book would prepare me to, you know, go become a Maori.
Yeah,
That's absurd.
exactly. You know, the idea that, you know, the American culture was so obvious and well broadcast across the world that anybody who had been paying attention automatically understood its details, its minutiae. That
Right.
was very, very silly, I thought. And
Right, but it shows you what people do believe in this idea that culture has been, let's say, flattened, you
yes.
know. And I,
They do, and it's not true.
right.
It's not true at all. I mean, people are really very, very different from one another.
Right, and I'm
Thank
very
goodness.
right, I'm glad that's true.
Yeah,
Well,
exactly.
I just one last question. I want to know, what is the next book? And as you alluded to it, but what do you have a name for it yet?
At the moment, it's called The Wonder Story of the World, which is also a quote. I always, you know, this is a quote from a guy named Elston Best, who is an ethnographer in New Zealand, and he talks about how he says, you know, if the true story of the, it's actually in his case, he's talking about Maoris in New Zealand, but the settlement of Polynesia could be known, it would be the wonder story of the world. And it's really an attempt to bring together all the different strands of information about, you know, what we know about who those people were who got in those canoes and sailed thousands of miles and settled unbelievably remote islands and unbelievably small islands. And it was just enormously daring. It's an astonishing chapter in human history. So that's
Well,
what I'm working on now.
sounds like a well, sounds like a book I'm going to want to read, so that's
I
good.
You might be my ideal reader.
I will try. Well, thanks, Christina. It's really been fun talking to you, and I'm really glad we had a chance to do this. The book is Come on Shore and We Will Kill and Eat You All, A New Zealand Story. The author is Christina Thompson. I'm David Wilk for Writer's Cast. Thank you very much.
Thanks, David.